You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, from Game of Thrones to a new Middle Earth TV series, lots of books are making the jump to the small screen. We'll ask you, what book do you want turned into a TV series? That's coming up in just a bit.
First, the Southern Poverty Law Center said it has seen a rise in the number of hate groups around the nation for the second consecutive year.
A new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at hate groups here in the state.
Mukhtar Ibrahim is a federal law enforcement reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News and a former investigative reporting fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's been looking at this. Mukhtar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what do some of these hate and bias incidents that you wrote about look like here in Wisconsin?
So I have spoken to several people who study these hate crimes and hate incidents, and some who are some of them who are based in Madison and Milwaukee. So they basically told me that they have been seeing a rise in hate and bias incidents across the state, and this has started to pick up around 2015 when, during the presidential election, when Trump was a candidate, and it has increased since then.
And what do some of these incidents look like when you were talking to people who have experienced them?
So some of the incidents are, most of them are unreported in the local news, but they are mainly harassment, intimidation, graffiti that are spray painted on Jewish centers, and some students who complain that they have been they are not feeling welcome at the college campuses, and it's kind of across the board, to just say the least.
So we've been having these incidents, but there are also, you know, hate groups in Wisconsin. So let's go through just a couple of those. Tell us a little bit about the White Boy Society.
So the White Boy Society is, it calls itself a biker brotherhood that aims to protect the heritage of the white people. And some of these groups also, like, hate the label hate group. They think that the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is the group that basically studies these groups and tries to have a clear picture of who they are, they go through their websites and their missions and objectives, and they try to designate some groups as hate groups, but like, people who are running these groups hate that label. They say they are not hate groups. They are just trying to protect their heritage and kind of basically try to protect their race.
Yeah, and the many of these that when you wrote about them, a lot of them, not all of them, said, we don't identify as a hate group. We're trying to protect our collective ethnic group. One of those is the Nation of Islam. So it isn't necessarily just a white or seemingly a white supremacist group, but obviously the Nation of Islam is one in a whole sea of potential hate groups in Wisconsin. And there are some groups that aren't categorized as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And obviously the Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the best known because they are monitoring this. But these groups are still controversial. Can you give us a couple of examples of some of these groups that might not be categorized as a hate group but still cause controversy?
I think one of the most well-known groups that actually it's not well-known, it's a fairly new group. It's called the Proud Boys. It was founded by Gavin McGinnis, who publicly proclaims that he is anti-Islam. So they believe that the West is the best, basically another version of saying, you know, the whites should probably rule the country, or somehow the whites will have some superiority of how the country is being run. They believe, like, very conservative. They hold very conservative views, and they lean toward the far right, but like they don't want to be called a white supremacist group or neo-Nazi, and they try to basically threaten anyone who calls them those terms. They don't like it. They will threaten that they will sue you. So it's very it's hard to describe. Basically, it's a very ambiguous group that its mission is just very confusing, and they I think they support Trump, and they try to kind of become the new right, basically.
We're talking to Mukhtar Ibrahim. He is the federal law enforcement reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News and a former investigative reporting fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And we're talking about a piece that he wrote for the Center for Investigative Journalism looking at the hate groups that have been established in Wisconsin. And Mukhtar, why is it hard to track hate groups in Wisconsin?
Well, these groups are some of them basically operate under very obscure online platforms, and when they come together, some of them even they fall apart very quickly, and they form splinter groups that that are not basically known. But these are there are 9 groups that are currently identified as hate groups in Wisconsin, but I'm sure there are some groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center didn't capture or didn't know about. You know, it's trying to kind of, the Southern Poverty Center tries to see any official reports or any media reports about these groups, and they try to go after, try to find out more information about those groups. But there are some groups that don't like to talk to the media, or they just come together as a group and talk about the issues. So that's, I think, one the most challenging part of when I was doing this piece, was trying to figure out the membership levels, or even like trying to find anyone who belongs to this group. It's really challenging to find some of the leaders or where they meet, and that's why we don't know much about these groups.
So you were looking specifically at hate groups in Wisconsin, but we've also been talking a little bit about sort of incidences of, you know, hate crimes in the state. And what do these statistics show when it comes to, you know, how many hate crimes are being committed in Wisconsin?
The official statistics from the Department of Justice shows actually a decrease in hate crimes in Wisconsin for the second straight year. The latest FBI data that just came out this week showed there were only 34 hate crimes reported in the state, which last year, in 2015, that was 43. And the year before that, I believe, was 51. So when you look at the hate crimes from the official line, from the official FBI data, Wisconsin is not actually doing bad. It's the hate crimes are going down compared to my home state, Minnesota, which has reported 119 hate crimes in 2016, which was an uptick from the year before. So compared to Minnesota, where I live, Wisconsin is doing much better. But when you go to organizations like the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, you will get a different picture. That organization collects anti-Semitism incidents, and things have been going way up. Like, it has been, they have seen a lot of reports, a lot of calls from the community, and they have collected like dozens of incidents in 2016 and 2017, and they think that they will have they will see an increase this year compared to the year before, and that's what has been happening, I think, since 2015.
So it kind of sounds like the Milwaukee Jewish Federation's numbers versus the FBI could be just that the criteria that would count for a hate crime is probably different between a federal organization and an organization that's been monitoring what's happening to its members.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, the FBI just gets these numbers from local law enforcement agencies. It's optional. only these law enforcement organizations are, some of them report, some of them don't report. And it's also hard to prosecute a hate crime because, like, you have to basically, you have to show that this person committed the crime with the intention that they hate the victim's race or identity or religion, and that's hard to prove. So it's hard to also, like, you know, prosecutors they have a hard time taking on hate crime crimes because they have to, like, they have to prove, and it's hard to prove someone's intent unless they clearly say, you know, they hate that person because he or she is a Muslim or Hispanic or a Jewish. Unless they do that, it's hard to win a case because of someone committed a crime based on something. So that's the challenge that law enforcement entities also face. But, like, if you go to like, for example, the Native American students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, they will tell you that they have been intimidated, they are not feeling welcome on campus, and they have been seeing some graffitis painted on places that they think are sacred. So those kind of, like, underreported issues are what's making people frightened a little bit.
Mukhtar, we'll have to leave it there for now. Mukhtar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Mukhtar Ibrahim. He is a federal law enforcement reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News and former investigative reporting fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He joined us to share his reporting on the increase in hate groups in Wisconsin. But right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Names are powerful. They can connect us to history and memory, to origins. Crystal Chan grew up with two names, one American and one Chinese.
The first time I realized that my mom was not mom, I was 5 years old. I lived in Oshkosh, and in the park across the street, the recreation department put on summer programming for children. I asked mom if I could go, and she said yes, so I ran across the street. The leader started registering me. "What is your mom's name?" she asked. I was confused. "Her name is Mom." The woman smiled. "What is her real name?" Something deep inside me tremored. "What do you mean?" "Go back to your mom and ask her what her real name is," the woman said tenderly. I ran back home in tears. Mom's real name? Who was she if she wasn't Mom? Was she an alien? Was I really her daughter? I dashed into the house, the door slamming behind me. "What is your real name?" I cried. "What do you mean?" Mom asked. "And who asked you this?" It was true. Mom was not Mom. The tremor exploded inside of me, and I broke down in sobs. Mom took me in her arms and gently explained that the entire world does not call her Mom. She told me her other name and walked me across the street to register. I, too, have another name. My English name is Crystal Melinda Chan, but that is not my full name. When I was born, my dad, who is Chinese, gave me a Chinese name. It is Mei Sun, which means beautiful coral. He grew up in Hong Kong, an island surrounded by coral. I grew up in Wisconsin, surrounded by land, and have never seen coral in my life. My name doesn't fit in the Midwest. And my name didn't physically fit either. On my birth certificate, because they do not have the space for additional names, my dad had to hand write in the traditional characters of my Chinese name. My dad called me by my Chinese name only when I was in trouble. Other than that, my name was hidden, a secret. When my novel, Bird, came out and started to be published around the world, my agent wanted to see if they could get my book into the Chinese market. She was a little hesitant, then said, "I'm so sorry I don't know this, but do you have a Chinese name? It could be helpful when we pitch the book to the Chinese publishers." My heart trembled again. Could there actually be a place in the world for my Chinese name? It was such a deeply hidden part of me, and it so rarely had the chance to surface, to have a purpose beyond people's idle curiosity. But maybe there was a place now, a place for all of me, with all my names. Yes, I told my agent, my voice thickening, I have a Chinese name. I'll write it down for you.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and the author of Bird. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And now, some advice from a well-known TV character.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
So you play the Game of Thrones, it's win or die. But HBO found out that when you adapt the Game of Thrones for the TV, you have a big hit on your hands.
And that has other TV content providers looking for the next Game of Thrones, a book to TV adaptation that turns into a cultural sensation.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What book or series of books would you like to see turned into a TV series? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Amazon is rolling the dice on the Lord of the Rings. They're getting a TV treatment from Amazon, and they're working on a streaming show that's going to cover some of the time period before the Fellowship of the Ring. Is that something you'd want to see, or is there another book you'd like to see in TV form? Again, you can call 800-642-1234.
Right to your calls now. Jeff is on the line in Mount Horeb. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A book that I love, and an author that I love, Neal Stephenson, he wrote a fantastic, sprawling science fiction novel called Seven Eves. Seven Eves
sure.
Starts with this amazing conceit where the moon blows into a number of large pieces, just literally explodes in slow motion up in the sky, which sets off a chain of events. Physicists determine that in 2 years the Earth is going to be destroyed by the bolide strikes as the moon's pieces rain down on the Earth and destroy it. And how will they save humanity? And they determine that the Earth won't be inhabitable again for another 5,000 years. And Neal Stephenson does an amazing job of spanning that 5,000 years from the saviors of humanity to the people who come back to repopulate the planet.
And Jeff, I can't promise you they'll turn that into a TV series, but we had Neal Stephenson on the show when that came out. We did talk to him about Seven Eves, so check the WPR archives if you haven't listened to that.
I'm going to go back and listen to it. I love his writing, and if you love science fiction, speculative fiction about science, he really is one of the best. He creates a scenario, and he really goes deep into the true physics of the situation. So,
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234.
And we're also taking your comments on Facebook. And Tim suggests Breakfast of Champions, and he admits that, of course, it's already been done already, but why not do it again and without Bruce Willis? he doesn't seem to be a Bruce Willis fan in that role. And he says on the why, because he thought it was Kurt Vonnegut's best book.
And back to your calls at 800-642-1234, looking for the book you want to see turned into a TV show. Wendy is with us in Fond du Lac. Wendy, hi.
Hi. I'm a middle school teacher, and a series that has gotten really big with students is a book series. The first book is called Aragon, and it's about a young boy, and he finds a magical stone, and what he realizes later is the magical stone is really a dragon's egg, and then the dragon egg hatches and it becomes his dragon, and it's a long, you know, the series has now become four very large novels actually. And the cool thing about it was written by a 16-year-old boy, and who is homeschooled, and it's very eloquently written, and the vocabulary and the description in it is amazing. Now, they made a movie of it, and I often, the kids who read the book, we watch the movie, and they're like, that's terrible. It was awful. We got so much out. And I love that because it just reinforces why you should read books instead of just watching the movie. But it could be done so much better if it could be drawn out and all the details and the beauty of the book and the dragons and the battles and the land. So
sounds
it
very
great. Much has the feel of like Lord of the Rings or that, you know. I think the same audience would enjoy it just as much.
Wendy, thanks for the call.
So it does seem that there are a lot of people who want to see fantasy or speculative / science fiction books make it to TV adaptations. But then we have Linda, and she says the Mitford and Father Tim series by Jan Karen. I'm just looking at family dynamics that are both serious and funny.
One more quick call. Fawn is with us. Fawn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was just reading a book of my husband's family that's so engrossed that I got really into it. And the book is from The Laundry. It's the last book, didn't read all of them. The last book in the series, The Laundry Files.
The Laundry Files. We're not hearing you real well there, Fawn, but The Laundry Files is the title of that book. We heard a lot of suggestions from our colleagues, too, of the Amelia Peabody series, Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum, Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. A lot of people have hopes for books turning into TV shows. Thanks for all your calls.
First, caregiving is one of those things that most of us will have to do at some point in our lives, whether it's an aging parent or a spouse. Most of us will be thrust into a caretaking role, whether we're ready for it or not. And that can bring on all sorts of emotions, including grief, anger, sadness, and much more.
But while caregiving can often feel like or sound like a burden, our next guest says it can also be a blessing. In a new book, she shares strategies for living the best life possible while caregiving, how to make the most out of the time with the person you're caring for, and what caregiving can teach us about preparing for our future needs.
Ann Kaiser Stearns joins us now. She's a professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. Her new book is Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Ann, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted.
So as we said there in the intro, even if people don't like to admit it, caregiving can often feel like a burden. And you say it can also be a blessing, or at least a blessing and a burden at the same time. Can you break that down for us?
You bet. One of the things we need to understand has to do with the cost we pay if we don't take care of ourselves. I like to call to mind John Henry, who was a railroad builder, the legendary steel driving man who hammered a steel drill into rock at such a fast pace that he won a race against a steam-powered hammer and then fell over dead. And one of the things that happens in America is we have a tendency, because we value self-sufficiency and perseverance and hard work, we have a tendency to overly praise caregivers who are paying too large a price for taking care of their loved ones and need more encouragement to be taking care of themselves. One of the things we know is that folks who don't get the kind of care, self-care they need, or the support from other family members or community resources, folks who don't get the kind of support they need literally age faster themselves. And some studies indicate they may be more likely to get dementia themselves. So it's urgent. It's kind of like riding an airplane where they say, you know, put the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on your loved one who needs assistance. So the first thing caregivers have to do is figure out, how can I take better care of myself, whether it's to get some paid help a few hours, several days a week. One of the most important things is to get regular respite and to not use your help that you get or the time your loved one is at a memory care center, to not use that to do your shopping or house cleaning. You need to use that for your own exercise, for your own friendships, for your own card games, for your own movies, for your own time with your own grandchildren, or children. We have to take care of ourselves if we're going to take care of others.
Sure. And so that also sounds sometimes as though it's easier said than done.
Absolutely, of course.
So for people who are in caregiving roles, what are some ways for them to maybe unburden themselves from wanting to take time for themselves in that, making it okay for them to take some respite?
Well, one of the things we know is that We have to change the way we're thinking about the time we spend with our person we're caregiving, doing the caregiving for. Some of that time can also include respite. For instance, people tend to say, oh, I won't go see my grandmother because she won't remember that I was there, or we falsely assume that the person is increasingly, quote, not there. We need to understand that even a person with advanced Alzheimer's may have lost 10 or 20 or 30 billion brain cells, but they still have 90 or 80 or 70 billion brain cells left. And that elderly person, whether they have dementia more advanced or earlier on, responds to sunshine, sunsets, flowers, gardens, moonlight, trees, a ride in the country, porches, patios, music, touch, facial expressions, prayer, scriptures, poetry. It's so important to know that there are many of those things we can still share with our loved ones, including, if the loved one is capable of it, walking, finding ways to get outside, finding ways to still get exercise. So that's one thing caregivers can do, is they can do some of those lovely things with their loved one, and those things are highly nourishing and calming to the elderly person, but also to the caregiver.
And your book looks at a lot of aspects of caregiving. And one of the big things is that people are living longer, and sometimes their children are a little bit older to begin with. So maybe someone needing some caregiving is in their 90s, right, and their children are in their mid-60s to 70s.
Exactly. My brother and sister and I were in our 60s caring for our parents in their 80s. And basically, it's so important. I have 23 pages of resources in my new book, Redefining Aging. There are so many resources. Many of them are free, like through the Alzheimer's Association. There are so many ways to tap in community resources and to avail ourselves of the kinds of support. All we need is a few hours a day, several days a week at least, and some vacations worked in. We have to find those ways of taking care of ourselves. I'd like to also, however, talk about successful aging. In terms of the caregiver, we have to get away from those ageist stereotypes. And one of the things we know is that from the research that's been done out of Yale School of Public Health and other places, we know that people tend to form their view, stereotype positively or stereotype negatively, their view of aging in their midlife, in 40s. So if you're in your 40s, you are shaping in your brain the notions of how you will age. And we've followed those folks longitudinally, and we've seen that someone who shapes up a negative view of aging 23 years later is fulfilling that prophecy. We have to think about, how am I going to age successfully? And we know that the way to do that, more than anything else, is through exercise. A person who walks 30 minutes a day cuts their risk of Alzheimer's in half. We've studied the brains, the healthy brains of 69-year-olds, and we followed them to 78. And we see in those brain scans that people who were walking from 6 to 9 miles a week or 30 minutes a day, those folks were growing gray matter in their brains during those years when we would be expecting from 68 to 79, 69 to 78, we would be expecting them to be losing gray matter. So exercise is key. Social contact is key. If I could say, what are two of the biggest ways to take care of yourself? It is through regular exercise and regular time with other people.
And we're talking right now with Anne Kaiser-Stearns. She is a professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. Her new book is Redefining Aging, and we're talking about how caregivers can achieve the best possible life for those that they care for and for themselves.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. Are you currently a caregiver for a family member, maybe a spouse or someone else? If so, what kind of emotions are you experiencing right about now? Are you able to take care of yourself? Get that exercise our guest is talking about, those social connections. What could help you be a better caregiver? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation with Ann Kaiser Stearns. She is the author of Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you been a caregiver, maybe for someone in your family? What was that experience like? Were you able to take care of yourself while you were doing it? Do you need some advice on taking care of yourself as a caregiver, or you know someone who's a caregiver? You want to know what you can do to maybe help them out? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Ann, let's say a listener out there.
Share some specific tips, if you'd like, about caregiving that can be helpful to folks, if you'd like for me to share that.
Sure. Well, actually, what I think the first thing we'd like to look at is, sometimes this is thrust unexpectedly on us. So can we start with maybe someone who might be a caregiver unexpectedly first, and then maybe go into people who've been doing this a little bit longer?
Yes. Well, one of the things that is surprising about the research, someone might say, I can't take care of my mom and keep my job. The studies show that it really is better, if at all possible, for you to keep your job, because what happens when we go to work is we are with other people, we have the fulfilling experiences of doing our jobs and doing them well, it raises our self-esteem, we have a lot of control of what's going on in our lives, whereas when we're dealing with our loved one who may have Alzheimer's, we may be mourning the ways that their life is slipping away, or we may be really overstressed from how difficult it is at times to interact with this person and do the caregiving. So the studies show that if at all possible, it's better to keep your job, or at least to keep a part-time job, to have a way to get away so that you aren't 24/7 being a caregiver.
And for those who've been doing this for a long time, could they be more prone to any sort of depression as they
Absolutely.
Deal with this moving forward?
Yes, they can be prone to depression and various kinds of anxiety problems. And there's also a level of mourning that a person may have. If your spouse isn't the person that you married many years ago and you've lost so much of what you were able to share with them, or the same thing about your sibling or your parent, there's a process of mourning that is one needs to go through. And yet it's hard to do that if you're being a caregiver constantly without finding ways to have respite. I also think it's really important to understand that there can be too much of a good thing. If you are an overly conscientious caregiver, trying too hard all the time to do the right things, you may inadvertently be putting the person you care for in a straitjacket, resulting in a struggle that you don't want. You may get into a struggle with the person of, you must take your medicine right now. You must not wear this same pair of trousers that you've been wearing 5 days in a row. We have to use some creative thinking and say, maybe I should ask the doctor, does my mother have to have this medicine right then, right after breakfast, or do I have some flexibility about when to give her the medicine? If I'm getting into conflict with her by trying to insist that she take it at the time that the bottle says, does it really matter if he wears the same trousers 5 days in a row? Why not sneak them out to wash while he's asleep, or let him wear them another day? Another thing that we need to know is that there are some skills and strategies we can use that reduce our stress, because they're more likely to help the elderly person not have what we call a catastrophic reaction of becoming breaking down into tears or resisting or fighting. And some of those include how we talk to the person. One of the researchers I came across, who is a nurse with a PhD out in Oregon, she uses the acronym DANCE, Don't Argue, Accept Realistic Limitations, Nurture Yourself, Creative Problem Solving, Enjoy the Moment, you know, D-A-N-C-E. It's important when a family member has dementia to remember that the most important thing you can possibly do is to be warm and kind and respectful.
And Anne, I'd like to get to a caller really quickly.
Yes,
Stacy is in Middleton. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Thank you so much for covering this important topic. I really just wanted to let people know that we're holding in Middleton at the high school, the Performing Arts Center, this Sunday afternoon, a community resource fair for families
Great.
Affected by dementia. And it's a wonderful program. And we really encourage people to stop by. You can just Google Living Well with Dementia, Middleton, and you'll find the information.
And thank you so much for that call, Stacy. And so, Anne, for those out there who might feel a little isolated in their caregiving, obviously they get to spend time with their family members. What about working with other people in the last, 45 seconds that we have here?
Yes, it's just so important to tap into resources. There are many resources available, like your caregiver just mentioned. A person has to look into them. Your physician will have those. Your clergy person will have those ideas. Other family members, other friends who are in caregiving roles. But I can't emphasize enough how important it is to take care of yourself and to think about how you yourself, the caregiver, will age successfully. And I've written in Redefining Aging just as much about our aging successfully as caregivers as I've written about how to learn skills and ways of working with your elderly loved one to be a better caregiver and not get burned out.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Anne Kaiser-Stearns is a professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. Her new book is Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life.
There's still time for you to share maybe your lessons learned as a caregiver yourself, something that might help someone else in that situation now. You can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page. What helped you? Made sure that you were able to take care of yourself? And if you, like our caller from Middleton, know of a community resource in your area, let us know about that too. You can do all that again at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
UW superior leaders say a move to suspend 25 programs was not driven by budget cuts. Instead, they say they're trying to eliminate poor-performing majors and minors. Daniel Kading reports they're responding in part to the state's plan to tie new funding for University of Wisconsin schools to their performance.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho! These program cuts have got to go! Hey, hey!
Around a dozen alumni, faculty, and students rallied recently at UW-Superior to protest the program suspensions, including Carson Wetzel. The UWS junior is working toward a bachelor's in art therapy and planned to pursue her master's. But the graduate program is one of the 25 being suspended.
I might not be able to pursue my dream because to receive certification to become an art therapist, you are required by the American Art Therapy Association to obtain a master's degree.
UWS suspended 20 programs several years ago to save money and address a $4.5 million budget shortfall. This time, campus leaders say they're eliminating some due to low enrollment and poor graduation rates. UWS Interim Provost Jackie Weisenberger says their decision isn't directly linked to funding.
Several on the suspension list are those programs that students are taking a long time to complete their degree, and that is one of the performance metrics I am fairly confident we're going to be gauged on and would potentially be tied to funding.
The reason for that is the University of Wisconsin system received $36 million in new funding under the next two-year state budget, much of which will be tied to performance. Heard here on Wisconsin Eye, UW System President Ray Cross said earlier this year that he would like institutions to be able to choose how they measure their performance.
Some would be improvement metrics. Some would be excellence or maintenance metrics. That would respect the unique missions of each institution. But all must contribute to the system-wide metrics and improvement for statewide issues.
But Governor Scott Walker disagreed, saying they'd likely choose metrics that would be easiest for them to improve or maintain. Now it will be up to the UW Board of Regents to design a formula that will gauge performance on student success, graduation rates, and workforce needs. UWS Chancellor Renee Wachter says that creates a greater sense of urgency.
The longer action gets delayed, the harder it is to make those numbers move in a timely manner to be able to access funding or access support.
Researchers disagree on whether performance funding ultimately benefits schools like UW-Superior and their students. David Tandberg is a policy analyst with the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. He examined the number of degrees awarded in states that do and don't tie funding to performance.
We generally found there wasn't a statistically significant increase in completions, although in a few instances where performance funding existed for 5 to 7 years or longer, we would see some small increases in completion.
Kate Callahan with Research for Action says evidence suggests performance funding can focus policies to improve student success. But she says formulas that weigh heavily on the success of students completing their degrees could encourage schools to avoid enrolling low-income or underrepresented students that often take longer to finish. As Wisconsin starts developing its own performance funding formula, Callahan says it's important to recognize that some campuses serve students who need more support and provide those resources.
If they don't, then I do think what we see is these policies can have negative impacts on specific institutions or more vulnerable students.
UW-Superior says just under half of its roughly 2,600 students are first-generation college students, many of whom struggle to pay for school, like Carson Wetzel. She has to consider dropping out now that UWS has suspended the Master's Art Therapy program.
Maybe attempt to go to somewhere else, but the likelihood of that happening is very slim.
She just doesn't know if she could afford the move or starting over with another major. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.